Ben Moore has been in love with bees for as long as anyone can remember. And as far as we can tell, the feeling is entirely mutual. Although he still sometimes feels the sting of his passion. Hang around, learn a little. It's as sweet as honey and always a buzz. It's the Ultimate Pollinators Podcast with Ben, his friends and associates, and of course, Ben's bees.
Hey everyone, Benny's back. I've dusted the mic and I've learned how to reuse this software. It's been that long. So thank you everyone for your patience. And I hope everyone has had an amazing spring. We're in the summertime now and about to sort of fire up the podcast. So thank you everyone. Now, obviously bees, I'll tell you what, with bees, there are highs and there are lows in there. But the good news is, I'll tell you what, I know in Melbourne, the weather has been so, so much better. Compared to last 2 years, they said this El Nino, don't know what that's about because we've still had a few rainy days here in Melbourne, but you know the bees, they're full, they're happy. But what's interesting to note, I don't know if someone's got an explanation to this, someone explain this to me. How come this spring I've done almost half the amount of swarms compared to last year when it was raining? Nick, a beekeeping friend of mine said to me, September last year, there was 6 sunny days. This year, there has been 6 rainy days during September. So explain to me why the bees haven't swarmed as much. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? So it's very, very interesting. But it's been lots of honey. I've been busy getting around and checking all the sites and so forth. It's been absolutely incredible. Also, too, very interesting, you know, regards to the industry, you know, the varroa, obviously, we're all, you know, we're probably a little bit like COVID, we're all probably a little bit sick of talking about it in one way or another. We've just got to deal with it and we'll deal with it the best way we can. But interesting about honey prices, you know, it's really amazing. Obviously, there's a big talk about that, you know, the importation of honey coming from overseas. And I recently just got a newsletter that, you know, that Capilano, so if you're not contracted, they're paying $3.50 per kilo of honey. So my heart goes out to a lot of beekeepers out there because, you know, the cost has gone through, insurances have gone up, you know, 30%. Diesel prices, you know, they've dipped back down a little bit, but they were at an all-time high over the last sort of few months. So it's been absolutely incredible. And prices, you know, up and down. And so hopefully everyone's doing well on that sort of perspective. If you're a commercial beekeeper and if you're a hobbyist recreational beekeeper, I hope you're doing well. But got some sad news, really sad news, absolutely breaks my heart. But we lost a very, very good beekeeper recently. So Jeremy Scott, he was a good dear friend of mine, an absolute beautiful human, and unfortunately we lost him. So it's such sad, sad news. So as I say at the end of every podcast, you know, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and take care of those bees. And it's so important. I'm going to say that take care of yourself, take care of each other. Very, very, very important. So, you know, we've got to be there. You know, as far as, you know, with bees and being an industry, it can be very insular world as a commercial beekeeper. For me, it's sort of been full on. I just absolutely full on in a good way. You know, having, you know, so many phone calls and helping people with bees, and obviously running my own bees. It's been absolutely incredible. So make sure look after each other. Very, very important. And now, super excited. So I've got some amazing guests lined up, and we've got a scientist on this episode. So coming in the new year, I'm going to have some really cool speakers. I might even get a couple of people we've had on previously and have a chat with them and, so you know, obviously see how they're going. You know, how's the season's been for them? You know, over in America, you know, how in the UK, in Europe, you know, what's it been like for them? So, very super excited for this episode. And also to a big shout out to all the people who send me text messages. No, really appreciate it. Just going, hey Benny, you're all right. You know, I mean, I can't do the podcast because it's just so insanely busy for me during spring. But thank you, everyone. Just, you know, messages there. I had this one message It was absolutely lovely to say they listen to every podcast, and it equates to over 74 hours. Over 74 hours. That's absolutely incredible. So, and I appreciate everyone's support. So, looking forward to this next guest. I am super excited for this next guest. Absolutely awesome to fire up the Bees with Ben podcast for this year. And on the line, I have Dr. Andrew Neil. How you doing?
Hi, how you going, Ben?
What's up? What are you doing right now?
Well, I'm actually in the lab at the moment. I work in a lab in Wardyallock in Melbourne, and we were making up a formulation. I work on polyurethanes at the moment, and we were tinting it with a specific color, and I've managed to spill it all over the floor, and it's gone everywhere. So I've made a hell of a mess. But just before you called, I managed to go around and clean it all up and extract it out of the carpet as much as I could with acetone, et cetera. But I think I've managed to salvage it.
Absolutely love it. Love it, Andy. Now you're a scientist. Now I'm curious, how does one A, become a scientist, and B, why did you want to become a scientist?
Okay. So A, how does one become a scientist? You go to university for a very long time, probably a lot longer than what a normal doctor or a lawyer would go. A scientist would probably call himself a scientist if he/she has done a PhD in science. PhD is a doctor of philosophy. Usually you go to university, you get an undergraduate, which is a 3 years undergraduate, you then go on to do honours or masters, and then after that, which is another year, you do a PhD, which takes usually between 3.5 and 4 years. So all up, I was at university for about 8 years.
Wow.
The reason for wanting to become a scientist, I've always been interested in problem solving, always been interested in wondering how things work. I probably get that from my father. Enjoy just working out problems and that's what a good scientist, I believe, is someone who can actually utilize what they've got in their head to be able to solve problems, I guess.
Okay, interesting. And so you've spent some time working at CSIRO, haven't you?
Correct.
Okay, is that where you are now, or is that you're at a different...
No. That was quite a while ago, actually. That was probably near 20 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I was at CSIRO. Okay. Yeah. I worked at CSIRO. I worked at a couple of different sites. I worked at a group called the Chemical Synthesis Group, which is in Mulgrave. I don't believe they're there anymore, but probably the majority of the time I spent at the Australian Animal Health Laboratory, which is down in Geelong. Very, very interesting site because it's the only site in the Southern Hemisphere that can handle level 4 containment biologics, meaning your anthrax and your AIDS viruses and all that sort of stuff. It's a very interesting site. It's not very well known. It's down in Geelong, but they if anyone's seen the movie Outbreak,
yes.
where they wear all the gear and all the double protection to sort of not allow any organisms into the body. That's sort of all the gear that they wear, and that's the real life work that they do down there. But I was actually working for another part, the same site, but more the chemistry, not the biology. It was called the Plant Toxins Research Group, and lots of people might think plant toxins research group is a bit of an oxymoron, or plant toxins in itself, but there are certainly many plants out there that are toxic, and we were looking at a variety of different projects, and all mainly because it's CSIRO, mainly ways in which toxins can enter into the human food stream via various ways.
Oh, okay, we're going to come to that, because that's obviously we know one way that sort of gets into our food. So now when you say, so studying sort of the toxicity of plants, because the first one that comes to my mind is that one, I think, you know, people die, I believe, maybe every year or every now and then, is the oleander. That was a common sort of, because that's a really heavily toxic plant, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is very toxic. It's also, I think, probably it's the main thing for us is the toxicity associated with our livestock, and that's what CSIRO was very focused on. You'll probably talk more about this, but the Patterson's Curse story. Yes. It was originally called, I believe, you know, that lovely purple flower that grows. It was originally called Salvation Jane, I think. I'm not entirely sure. You probably would know the story better than me, but then, or maybe it, no, actually, I think it's the other way around, isn't it? It was originally called Patterson's Curse because if the livestock ate it, it killed them because it was toxic because of the toxins that were in there. But then the Salvation Jane side of the thing was that it helped.
Beekeepers.
It was very good for the beekeepers.
That's
because
right.
of the fact that the bees would forage on it. But there's swings and roundabouts there of good and bad things, that's for sure.
Yeah, so speaking of that, because as you know, Patterson's Curse, Salvation Jane, the bees, you know, as a beekeeper, commercial beekeepers put their hives on those crops because the bees just bubble, the nectar absolutely pours in, and you get these really big fat boxes of bees. Now, so talking about the toxicity getting into the food chain, now obviously we know that Patterson's Curse, I think the only thing that can eat it or a small amount is sheep because of their being a specific type of ruminate, I believe. They can have a small amount, but I think cows, other livestock die from it. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, that's specifically has certainly in the flowering part, it does contain. There are lots of plants out there that basically contain toxins, and most of them would they're either in the leaves or they're in the flower. And, you know, there are probably, I don't know how many species, but there would be quite a large number of species that these plants contain. The main reason, of course, for the presence of these toxins is to protect the plant against herbivores or herbivores. and for insects and to basically protect itself. And that's the reason why these plants have these toxins. They've developed, the evolutionary step has been to be able to develop these toxins in their system such that it protects itself. And that's what the toxins are there for.
That's interesting, fascinating. So Andy, so you spent some time, you know, researching Patterson's Curse and the effect of obviously going into honey. Tell us all about that, because this is some amazing research.
There is quite a lot of research out there. As I said, this is research that we did 20 years ago. And it was probably quite emerging at that time. Since then, there's been quite a number of countries that have actually looked at the possibility. These compounds are called pyrrolizidine alkaloids. I'll just give you a small rundown on what these molecules are and how they work. As I said, they're produced not only by Patterson's Curse, but by hundreds of different species. Flowering species that produce these alkaloids, and again, like what I said, they're using it to protect themselves against herbivores and insects. So basically, these pyrrolizidine alkaloids are very small molecules, compared to like a protein or a peptide. They are a small molecule, like what the majority of our drugs are, similar sort of size in molecular weight. Unfortunately, these pyrrolizidine alkaloids have shown to be carcinogenic, or they are cancer-causing substances. Because of the fact that they're set up in a similar way to, say, the way a mustard gas works, in that a mustard gas has an ability to be able to have two points where it can be attacked It can potentially cross-link DNA, and as soon as it can start cross-linking DNA, it just so happens to be the right size. Once it can cross-link DNA, it is a carcinogen or a genotoxic substance. So there are a number of these toxic substances, these pyrrolizidine alkaloids. There are probably 15 to 20 of them that have been known. And you know, these sorts of, generally it's European plants that contain them.
Okay.
You'll find, and of course, you know, Patterson's Curse itself has there is quite a lot of it's also about the quantity, the amount that you're able to detect in the plants, and various times, you know, you'll see small amounts in the leaves, but the majority you'll find in the flower and stuff like that. So these compounds are known carcinogens, and they can, not only can they end up in honey, but they potentially can end up in the vegetable harvest. If you've got pyrrolizidine alkali types of plants that end in there, that are in there, like, you know, your wheat crops and stuff like that. If you're doing like a herbal preparation of these sorts of leaves, the teas, the honey, and then of course the pollen as well. So all these sort of things can potentially end up in our food chain via these roots.
Absolutely fascinating. So doing the research with honey that's predominantly from Patterson's Curse.
Right. So
how bad
the research that we were doing, and again, 20 years ago, this research has been done. I haven't seen it many times being done in Australia since that original study that we did. But like you can look up pyrrolizidine alkaloids online, and you put in pyrrolizidine alkaloids and honey just into Google, and you will find that there are a numerous places around the world, mainly European. But when I had a quick look, you know, you look at there's quite a lot of you know, South American countries, surprisingly, that are also looking at levels. So they're really looking at the levels of these quantities. They're extremely low levels. Okay. That are in the plants. But of course, you know, a toxin, a genotoxin, is, you know, you want your levels in your foodstuff to be zero.
Yeah,
you
don't zero. That's right. Exactly.
You don't want them to be you don't even want them to be in nanograms. You want them to be in at zero, because it's a cancer causing substance. You know, you don't want any of these sorts of things. So there are a lot of studies that do this, and what they do is that essentially that they're trying to quantitate. Quantitation, of course, is the determination of the amount of these types of compounds that are in there, and they're looking at the quantitation of these pyrrolizidine alkaloids in the plant. Well, then, but the studies that we were doing was determination of the quantitation of the amount of these pyrrolizidine alkaloids that end up in the honey.
Okay.
Now, simply, without going into any huge amounts of details about how this is done. But basically, the honeys from various regions, we took like maybe 40, 50, maybe of honeys, and the way in which you take the honey, you extract the honey, you quantitatively determine how much honey you've got, and of that material, you extract out the pyrrolizidine alkaloids. You run these through there are various techniques you can use. GC stands for gas chromatography. And LC is liquid chromatography, and then you use a specific technique, the detection technique called mass spectrometry. So we call it GC-MS, which is gas chromatography mass spec, or LC-MS, liquid chromatography mass spectrometry. Where was that? That's right. It was GC-MS and
yes.
LC-MS.
Yes.
And the mass spec side of thing is used to determine what the molecule is. And the GC or the LC side of things is to you ultimately can quantitate the amount of, you know, I said that there's potentially 15 different types of pyrrolizidine alkaloids in each, and you know, some might have, you know, some might be 5, some might be 10, and then, you know, from this analysis you can determine the amount of each of these materials that are actually in there, and that's the work that was done at CSIRO. And if you look online and know what you're looking for, you can find I quite easily found another 10 studies around the world that have been done. It was Italy, there was some in South America, where they've also developed methods to determine or to quantitatively determine the amounts of these materials that are actually in the honeys.
Absolutely fascinating. So all that said, how bad is it? Like you sort of mentioned, we don't want any of that because obviously it's, you know, potentially carcinogenic. So would you try honey that's come from Patterson's Curse, Andy?
Look, I wanted to. I knew that this is obviously the big question that everyone wants to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
and this is obviously the hard part that the agencies around the world are obviously looking at, because they're the ones that are going to have to set limits.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, you know, the industry isn't big enough to be able to analyze every single batch of material that's made, because of the fact that, you know, it's not a simple process. You know, every batch that every small producer makes, let's say they produce 50 kilos at a batch. I don't know whether that's a big batch or a small batch.
Yeah.
And maybe there are big companies, your Capilano, that will put together 1,000 kilograms and blend it all up. But even at that, to analyze each and every single batch if there's a big cost associated with that, suddenly your costs of honey are going to go up exponentially, because if agencies start putting regulations in and start saying, you're not going to be allowed to sell this anymore unless you've actually done the specific analysis. And there are labs around Australia that would do this analysis for you. But again, it's costly. It's huge, huge cost. Like, you know, it might be $1,000 a sample. Like, and you can't be doing that. Like, that's obviously not feasible unless you're putting batches of, you know, 10,000 litres or 10,000 kilos together. So what the European Food Safety Authority, the EFSA, and this is something I was just looking up yesterday, they've done the smart thing. And what they've actually done is they've done testing on their own, they've basically taken, you know, specific regions, and they've taken, you know, 100 different honeys from those regions, and they've looked at the specific levels that are actually in these honeys at that time, over a period of time, and that they've got external laboratories to do all this testing, do all this quantitative analysis, and they've come up with levels that they believe you're going to find of these pyrrolizidine alkaloids in honeys. In addition to that, they've then looked at these pyrrolizidine alkaloids and they've said, okay, what level is actually potentially going to be bad for humans? And so they've come up with a limit, and there are limits like this of a whole bunch of different potential carcinogenic compounds in our foods. All agencies do this, and so they've come up with a limit. I'm not going to go into numbers or anything like that. It's not going to mean anything to anyone. But from what I've been reading, and the European Food Safety Authority has just recently put out something, so this isn't just 20 years ago, this is quite recent, but they basically said, look, you know, they haven't specifically said Australia, but they were talking about European, and European honeys are going to be a lot worse than Australian honeys, because I'll give you a bit of a rundown of what we did at CSIRO, and I'll give you the heads up on the results that we actually attained from that in a minute. But just let me say that, well, what they basically came up with, they came up with a recommendation of saying that it is, you know, the standard consumption, you know, without someone going ridiculous, having, you know, kilograms of honey on a daily basis for humans is completely acceptable in relation to the worst case scenario of European honeys.
Okay.
What they did focus on, and this is something that's probably, if there's going to be one takeaway from this discussion today, it's going to be for infants and for children, in that their consumption should be controlled, because I don't know if you're aware, and you know, I worked in cancer research. I worked for Pfizer for 17 years in cancer research, and so I've obviously got a fair amount of information about cancer research and the drugs that are used. But certainly the one thing that I've learned is that it is for cancer, probably the most important thing, I believe, is when your body is growing the fastest, and your body starts growing the fastest, it from the point of conception.
Yes.
Your body is growing extremely fast. Yes. You know, you've got one cell and it goes to two cells, and that's doubling the size, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So you grow your fastest from basically from the point that you are conceived. And then, you know, for the next 20 years, your body is, well, not 20 years, let's say 18 years, your body is growing extremely fast. And that is the point where you know, you're setting yourself up for what the rest of your life is going to be in relation to cancer. That's what I believe, other than the external things like eating wrong and smoking cigarettes and, yes, and drinking too much and all that sort of stuff. You know, for me, the most important thing is giving your children the right thing. And when they're growing extremely fast, you see kids, you know, that my God, you've grown an extra foot since I saw you last,
yeah,
Johnny. You know,
like, yeah,
they
exactly
grow so,
yes,
fast. And when you are growing at that extremely fast rate, that's the time when, you know, you want to keep any carcinogen out of your body, because it's what happens in the first 10, 15 years of your life that will, I believe, and this hasn't been proven or disproven, but this is just my thoughts. And, you know, that's what the European Food Safety Authority has said. These are the times when you want to be extremely cautious about anything carcinogenic. And so infants, you know, limit your consumption, for instance, and kids certainly control consumption. They're the take-homes, I think, from the message that I've learned about pyrrolizidine alkaloids in honey over the years.
Yeah, makes sense. And so was it just specifically Patterson Curse, nectar into the honey that you were studying, or was there any other plants?
No, we were looking at everything. We were most interested in getting, you know, we weren't interested in just getting your average Capilano blend from wherever. We wanted to know where these honeys came from. We wanted to know, is this a blue gum honey? Is this a specific Patterson's Curse honey? And yes, we did buy Patterson's Curse honey that advertised it. Well, they didn't call it Patterson's Curse. Of course, they called it Salvation,
yes,
Jane. But,
yes,
you know, we specifically bought these. And yes, these were the ones that gave the worst results. These were the ones that had the highest amounts. And this was completely expected because,
yes,
of the fact that we knew that Patterson's Curse has such huge amounts of pyrrolizidine alkaloids in there. And these were the ones that had the greatest amounts. But the good news for Australia, and this is maybe the second thing that people might like to take home from this podcast, is that the majority of the Australian natives, like your blue gums and your red gums and the mallees and stuff like that, they all contain very low levels of pyrrolizidine alkaloids. It was the ones where the bees foraged on the European plants, they were the ones that contained the worst results. And not just the worst results, they were the worst results, like, you know, in orders of magnitude worse. There was only one honey that came back without any pyrrolizidine alkaloids in it. Can you guess where that honey came from?
Oh, I'm going to say Leatherwood, Tasmania.
You are absolutely spot on. And we haven't talked prior, or have I?
No.
Have I told you that? No, I haven't talked.
No, we
are.
Yes.
Are absolutely spot, yes, on, because that is, if you want purity, you've got absolute purity down Leatherwood honey down in Tasmania. That's the only one that didn't come up with any pyrrolizidine alkaloids in it.
Absolutely fascinating.
Spot on.
That's
you've hit the winner there.
That's it's because I've heard Tassie's, you know, pristine. I think it's got the cleanest air in the world, and
yeah,
a lot of good things happen in Tassie, and a lot of people,
absolutely,
are moving there from the mainland.
I think so, but maybe that's not necessarily a good thing. Maybe the Tasmanians don't think much of that.
Yeah, don't want all the Mexicans crossing the border into Tassie.
Yeah.
And what about just touching base on, because we could talk for hours, Andy, but it's what about other, you know, honey aside, any other effects on, you know, various other, you know, grasses, plants, on any other livestock or anything other, you know, we consume?
Yeah, look, as like a lot of there's been a lot of work on you know, your ancient herbal remedies and stuff like that. You know, everyone's heard about that, the wondrous things that are potentially in these you know, that you know, everyone's got a story, a little granny that you know, someone that got cancer and they started, you know, instead of going for, you know, Western medicines, they went for all the ancient Chinese medicines,
yes,
and suddenly their cancers are gone. You know, there is certainly something to that. You know, I would I would say that, like, you know, these compounds, although these compounds, you know, we talk about them as being carcinogenic, they're also very active compounds as well. And like, you know, a lot of the and as I said, I've worked in cancer research for 17 years, and a lot of the to be able to even just handle these compounds, the gear that I have to wear to actually work with these substances is extreme. You know, there's the difference between there is an extremely fine line between a toxin and a cancer causing and an anti-cancer a product, basically. So there's a, you know, we fight fire with fire is what it sort of comes down to, certainly with cancer. So there are, you know, a lot of these ancient herbal remedies, they do contain very active molecules. And yes, there probably have been some cases where people, and I'm sure there would have been cases where people have given themselves, you know, acute toxicity, certainly for the liver, because of things that they've tried. And you know, there are some very interesting molecules, and we don't necessarily know what a lot of them are, that may very well be the next cure for cancer, you know. And so, yeah, it is very interesting. It's in a very interesting area, but it's a very unregulated area as well. So, you know, you can't stop selling ancient German, like, you know, these remedies. You can't. Then there is no regulations about what can and can't be sold in regards to natural products like that.
That's interesting. And last question, Andy, you know, sort of touch your base on cancer. How far away do you think we are in finding a cure? Do you think, or if we are, is it curable?
Look, I think there are, we're moving away from the small molecules. And that is, you know, the small molecules were the easy fix. I think, you know, we had to, you know, cancer has been worked on for the last 30, 40, 50 years, and the small molecules have certainly taken the charge in that they've been used quite a lot. We're moving more towards the biologics, more towards the peptides and proteins. Vaccinations is a big area where all that is heading towards, and I think it's a positive. It's definitely a positive. There, you know, there's also a lot of people using, you know, trying to build up their own immune response as well to be able to attack it, and I think this is all very, very positive. It's a very positive direction. So I think that we are progressing in relation to sort of having that one hit cure. No, I don't believe that's ever going to be there, and you know, people, well, you know, people 50 years ago, they just died and that was it, you know. And but these days, you know, we still have to die of something. That's the thing. We don't just, you know, it is the body saying, you know, I don't know, you know, what is natural causes? Is that just your body basically dying of the heart stopping, or is natural causes, you know? Yet the terrible cancers that are out there, of course, are the ones that take people way too early, and we've all been touched by that, and they're the ones that we really want to focus on, and that's where the majority of the research is happening.
Andy, absolute incredible podcast. So I just want to say thank you so much for your time. That was absolutely amazing, and I think we might have to I'll have to drag in again in the future, sort of touch base on some other things, because there's one little interesting bit of research is bee venom, but we won't talk about that now. We'll have to
We know all about bee venom, but you know, who knows where that's going? That's another very interesting area, that's for sure.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Andy. Really appreciate your time.
Okay. All right, mate.
That was absolutely incredible, sort of hearing about that. And because sometimes, you know, we talk about all the good things with bees, but you know, sometimes, you know, with bees collecting honey from, you know, Patterson's Curse, or as beekeepers like to call it, Salvation Jane, you know, and that research that Andy has done and what's happening around the world, absolutely amazing. But I was just thinking then, it sort of reminded me. So for the last, it must be, God, we'd be close to a decade. So in Bentley, there was this lovely Irish lady, Mary Barker. Now, Mary Barker this year turned 102 years old. And she, from Ireland, still had that, you know, strong Irish accent. And, you know, 2-3 times a year, I'd have to drop off a 15-kilo bucket of honey to Mary. And she swore by two things that helped her longevity. One was having honey on her porridge every morning. And the other thing is she always ate organs from animals, like, you know, steak and kidney pie, sauteed liver. And she swears that's her longevity was based upon the organs for animals and as well as honey. But unfortunately, Mary, she passed away about 5 weeks ago now. And at 102 years of age, she got the letter from the king. And it was the queen. So the Queen of England, who's since passed away. Absolutely fascinating. But Mary, she was a lovely thing, and she's up, and she was switched on 102 years of age. So absolutely incredible. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening to the podcast. Got lots more to come. If you want to hear someone, I've got some Western Australian beekeepers lined up. So because, you know, I've got a lot of beekeepers from WA sending me messages. You know, I want to hear this person, and because obviously WA, it's like a different country to us over in the east a little bit. But how fascinating. When talk about, you know, speaking of honey, Jarrah, you know, Jarrah honey, which is obviously unique to WA. So now don't forget, if you want to hear someone on the podcast, shoot me through a text message on 0437 077 92. And thank you once again for everyone's time. And until next time, don't forget, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and take care of those bees. Bye for now.